So a lot of you are bird lovers, and we really saw in Connecticut, especially during the pandemic, that bird enthusiasts really kind of came out of the woodwork because we were stuck at home, right? And people started to invest in more feeders and started to identify more of our native birds here in Connecticut and go for nature walks and identify some of the birds around and really spend time looking out our windows and sitting in our backyards and admiring them. And so we've been trying to get the Connecticut Audubon Society to come on maybe at least once a month because we know so many of you love to hear from them and learn more about our feathered friends in our backyards. And so I saw on their newsletter they had just released a few days ago, feed the birds and attract more to your yard in the winter and beyond. Sounds pretty perfect for many of us here on WICC. So joining us for the first time today is Miley Bull, who is the Senior Director of Science and Conservation at Connecticut's Audubon Society. Hey, Miley, welcome to WICC. How are you?
Hey, good morning, Sunshine. I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. Now, Miley, I was told to call you Miley, even though your first name is Mylin. Is Tom pulling my leg, or should we stick with Miley?
Yeah, as long as you don't call me late for dinner, I'm fine.
Okay, no, I will not do that. I promise you that. I will make sure that you
are
there
Miley
on time.
Yeah, Miley is good. All my friends call me Miley, so that's great.
I love that. I love that. Well, Miley, welcome to WICC. Thank you so much for being here. Yeah, we have a lot of bird lovers
Thanks.
Who listen to the show, and the Connecticut Audubon Society is always highly requested by so many WICC listeners. So we appreciate you being here. First of all, talk to us about feeding the birds in the backyard. I think in recent years especially, a lot of the Northeast, we get these warnings all the time about don't leave feeders up and don't attract bears and wildlife to your yard. But again, we have a lot of bird enthusiasts who love having so many different types of birds enter into their backyards. So what do you suggest when it comes to feeding the birds?
Okay, well, you know, first of all, people are always asking me, why the heck would I spend my entire career focused on birds? It's not for the money, right? So the reason is birds animate our lives, right? They connect people to nature like really nothing else can do. Mm. They're abundant. They're found nearly everywhere. They provide song, color, dimension to our lives, no matter where we live, in the cities, in the suburbs, everywhere. Not to mention the fact that birds are vital to our ecosystems as pollinators, pest control, seed dispersal, et cetera, et cetera. And most people, I think, and I don't know if this applies to you or not, but most people take bird song for granted. But can you imagine, you know, a silent forest, a nature preserve, open spaces, or even if you go down the beach without bird song?
Oh, it'd
so
be devastating.
So therefore, I think, so millions of people in the U.S. Feed birds. In fact, they spend a total of around $4 billion on bird seed annually, providing about a billion pounds of bird seed, suet, and other goodies to their backyard bird feeders. And so it's important, I think, that people connect with birds. And it's simple to do. You know, a simple bird feeder in your yard, as I said, provides animation, color, and song to your lives. And I think it's really important.
Yeah, and so if that's the case, which I agree with you, I do think it's very important. So what do you say to, I don't want to say lawmakers so much, but the call to get rid of bird feeders? I think it probably sounds silly, but it is a very devastating call for a lot of Connecticut homeowners who, like I think of my parents, for example. I've never known my parents not to have birdhouses and bird feeders in their backyard. But in recent years, especially working in the news, I've said, hey, you guys got to take your bird feeders down. You know, it's going to attract bears. It's going to attract other animals to your backyard. And I'm worried about you and dad. And my mom hates that. She hates that. She's I don't want that.
I think that's totally unnecessary. If you use common sense with your bird feeders, you're not going to attract bears. For instance, if you just put enough seed in your feeder that the birds clean it up every day, you won't have bird seed left over at night, and that's less likely to attract bears. So I have a few tips for feeding winter birds if you want me to tell you what they are.
I would love nothing more than to hear those. And again, we have Miley Bull, who is here with the Connecticut Audubon Society. He is Senior Director of Science and Conservation there. Yes, please share your tips, Miley.
Okay, so if you're starting out feeding birds, I would suggest, number one, use a tube-type feeder that has a tray underneath. So when the birds are feeding at the feeder, any excess seed goes onto the tray underneath, and other birds will take advantage of it. Then put your feeder on a pole that has a squirrel baffle near shelter, like low bushes and away from windows. So if there's a panic flight from birds, they're not going to fly into your window. Keep about 30 feet away. Mm. And also, birds need some shelter nearby. So if something like a predator, like a hawk, comes by, they can dive into the shelter and protect themselves from the predator. A good idea, what I do often, is take a couple of old Christmas trees and put them up near my bird feeder so the birds have a place to escape to.
Oh, that's such a good idea.
Yeah.
And then
number three, use a quality seed mix that contains black oil sunflower seeds. Black oil sunflower seeds contain a lot of the nutrition and fat that birds need in the wintertime.
Now,
Number four, go ahead.
Really quickly, Molly, do most of the bird seed mixes, or I guess bird feed mixes, like if you go to a hardware store or something, usually where they have those feeds, or if you go to like a farm or, well, you know, whatever, to go get those feeds, do they usually have that in there, or should people be looking closely at like the ingredient list?
Yeah, you should look at the ingredient list.
Okay.
A lot of more inexpensive bird seeds contain a lot of fillers like white millet, cracked corn, etc.
Interesting.
So you want to have a seed mix that has a lot of black oil sunflower seed in it.
Now, why is that, Miley? Why is that good for the birds?
Because it's got a high fat content that birds need to get by during the cold weather. So they need extra energy and fat reserves to stay warm during the winter and food scarce conditions. So black oil sunflower seeds have that high meat to shell ratio, and they are very nutritious and high in fat. And also it's a smaller size seed, so it's with thin shells, so it's easier for the birds to crack them open and eat them. So black oil sunflower seeds are probably the best.
Better quality food for them, and certainly that's the goal, right? I mean, we want to attract birds, obviously, to our yard and be able to enjoy them, but also we want them to have a healthy life, and we want to make sure that they continue to populate our yards and everything. So the better quality food for sure. All right, Miley, sorry, continue. I just wanted to see why that was the case.
Yeah, and then you should also include a suet feeder to your feeding station as well. And that provides an extra amount of fat for birds like woodpeckers, chickadees, and titmice that would like to get some extra protein. Mm. So suet feeders are really good as well. And there's a variety of different suet cakes you can get out there. Some are mixed with berries, some are mixed with peanut butter, et cetera. I wouldn't suggest too much the ones that are used that are mixed with peanut butter, because that just helps to attract more squirrels. But all the suet cakes are really good for your feeding station.
Interesting.
And then you should keep your feeders dry and free of ice and snow. And lastly, you ought to think about providing fresh water. In the wintertime, of course, water science hasn't been such a problem the last couple of winters because we haven't had a whole lot of ice. But during the really cold weather, when everything is frozen up, birds need water as well. And you can provide fresh water for your bird feeding station just simply by taking a simple bird bath, painting the inside of it with a flat black, non-toxic, maybe food-grade paint, and keeping it in a place near your yard where it's out of the wind and in the sun. And you'll be surprised how often that bird bath will have fresh water in it for birds. And all kinds of birds will use those the bird baths, not just the ones that are feeding in your feeder. So they're important things. Everything from blue jays to sparrows and chickadees and titmice and even crows. You know, you probably don't know that. You know, before the crowbar was invented, most crows drank at home. And most people don't even realize that. But
wow, I didn't realize that, actually. I didn't realize that. That's interesting. And again, we have Miley Bull, who is here. I have to play into your dad jokes. Come on now, Miley. I got you. Miley is here.
No, listen, I was so happy this morning to hear that most of your show has been up in the air.
Yeah, you should have heard Miley when he agreed to do this show. He's like, oh, I guess I could do it. I'll wing it. I'm like, oh, here we go. I've got one of these guys on my show. I love it. He might have some killer dad jokes, but I could tell you professionally that Miley Bull is the Senior Director of Science and Conservation at Connecticut Audubon Society. I can't believe Tom has left you off of this show for so long, Miley. It's just not
oh,
right.
Oh, no. That's on purpose. Believe me.
Well, I'm going to have to talk to Tom about this a little bit later. You know, we're talking about attracting birds to our backyards, what to feed them, and Miley's been giving these really great tips. And I was curious, though, Miley, for people who may not be familiar, especially if they've become bird enthusiasts, like I said in the top of this, you know, some people have just started to get, like, kind of got the bug for really wanting to learn more about birds. What birds can we expect on a yearly basis in Connecticut, not just in the wintertime, but throughout the calendar year?
Oh, there's over 400 bird species that are in Connecticut on a year-round basis. But in the winter, our non-migratory songbirds that are here are composed of things like woodpeckers, chickadees, titmice, some of our sparrows, etc. And a lot of these cardinals, blue jays, etc. And a lot of these are really beautiful, colorful birds that I mentioned before, Melissa, really animate our lives. And it's nice to sit at your kitchen table, look out the window, and see color and activity, and you're helping birds out a little bit in the wintertime by feeding them. But keep in mind that birds will never use your feeder as their sole means of support. They always have natural food sources that they can find. They'll take advantage of an abundance of bird feed at your feeder, but don't worry if you go on vacation, for instance, down south for a couple of weeks. A lot of people will say, "Oh, I don't want to feed birds because, you know, I'm not here for a couple of weeks in the wintertime. I don't want them to go hungry." Well, that's not true. Birds will always have an alternative source of food, so don't worry about that. But enjoy birds at your feeder. You're helping them out during the toughest time in the wintertime, and they'll provide a lot of cover. You know, and there's so many different bird species that'll be coming to your feeder. Don't worry about, you know, necessarily identifying every single species that come to your feeder. You should just enjoy them that are there. They provide some animation and color, and you're doing birds a favor.
Yeah, it's really amazing. And Miley, obviously, you have your website, ctaudubon.org, if people want to learn more. Do you have, like, a list of the different birds and maybe what they, you know, what they look like and things that people can look out for if they want to educate themselves more on the types of birds they could see in their backyards?
We certainly do. If you go to our website, www.ctaudubon.org, you can find all kinds of stuff that you can find out about birds. More than you need to know.
Well, I mean, listen, we'd rather more than less, certainly, and you could find it all at ctaudubon.org.
Did you know that there are about 10,000 bird species in the world?
No.
Yeah, there's about 10 or 11,000 species. And you know, can you guess what is the most abundant species of bird on this planet? I bet you can guess.
Pigeon.
No.
Oh. Which one?
Chickens.
Oh. That makes sense.
That's my last bad.
Is that really not the case though? Because that actually would make sense. What is the most, like, the biggest population?
I didn't say wild bird, right? I just said what's the most abundant bird species in the world? Those are chickens.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
Probably the most wild bird species would be red-billed quailia in Africa, probably. They exist by the zillions, yeah.
Huh. So, interesting. I was
anyway,
sure the
there's
pigeons
more information than you ever needed to know about bird feeding. So,
I love that. Well,
keep in touch. Get a hold of our website, and I'm happy to help.
I love that. And if we need more dad jokes, I'm going to have you come back on the show. That's really what, you know, the website doesn't have that. It's doing a disservice. It's not sharing your great jokes. So we're going to have you come back
on. You'll invite me on this show.
No, not true at all. I'm actually a huge fan. Huge, huge fan, Miley. And I will definitely be talking to Tom about having you on more often. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Have a great day.
Thank you. You too. Miley Bulligan, who is the Senior Director of Science and Conservation at Connecticut Audubon Society here on WICC. And one more time, it is ctaudubon.org for more information. Huge Connecticut news. The Goshen Public Library's Board of Directors is scheduled to meet this afternoon to discuss the decision last summer to remove Gender Queer. This is a 2019 memoir which touches on gender issues and sexuality. And it was removed because there were a lot of complaints that were filed with the First Selectman, apparently, in the youth section of the library. Now, it hasn't been permanently removed, but there are some who would like that to happen, while others say you're going down a slippery path here with banning any books, just in general. And again, this is at a public library. So we wanted to talk about this in more of a broad spectrum, if you will, not so much just the Goshen situation, because we've seen it even in recent news in Newtown about a year ago. We've seen it in Connecticut, across the country, banning books and the removal of books from public libraries and from school libraries. And so we wanted to get a professional's opinion on this. We've got Jordan Jefferson joining the show right now, an associate professor and director of the law library, actually, at Quinnipiac University, joining us to talk about censorship and book banning. Hey, Jordan, welcome to the show. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me. This is a topic that is near and dear to my heart and one that I'm very passionate about, so I'm happy to talk about it with you.
I mean, let's talk about the movement of banning books. I mean, would you agree, Jordan, that we've really seen this more in recent years, or has this been an issue for a long time?
Oh, well, there's definitely been an uptick. There's been a few hundred percent uptick in just the last couple of years. But this is an issue that has historic precedent in America and across the world. I mean, this, you know, going back to Nazi Germany, the suppression of information is something that has historical underpinnings forever, going back as far as history is recorded. But there has definitely been an uptick in America over the last couple of years. Just in Connecticut alone, we've seen 100 separate titles attempted to be banned across public and school libraries just in 2023, in just 8 months in 2023.
Interesting.
Which is, I think, just a very interesting statistic.
And when you talk about the books that are, you know, just looking at Connecticut, I don't know if you have these facts on you, Jordan, but the books that are being banned, I mean, it's hard to overlook that. It seems like a lot of them have to do with gender issues or with sexuality, the LGBTQ plus community, transgender. I mean, that seems to be the real point of contention for, it seems like, a lot of parents or people in towns who want these books removed. Do you find that is the case?
Well, definitely the often challenges are motivated by a desire to protect children or communities from what is deemed inappropriate. So it's usually materials that are considered to be sexually explicit or containing offensive language, or they're materials that are considered to be, quote unquote, unsuited to any age group. The question there, though, is whose morals, whose values, who's making those determinations?
Well, and so, again, Jordan Jefferson is here, who is an associate professor and director of the law library, actually, at Quinnipiac University. So I would imagine, Jordan, not to put words in your mouth, but I would think you are anti-banning books.
Oh, I'm anti-censorship, full stop. I believe that censorship and book banning undermine foundational principles of a free and just society. We thrive on open access to diverse information. You know, limiting what books are available not only infringes on our own individual rights, but hampers the collective intellectual growth and empathy developed through exposure to varied perspectives. I think it's bad for society to censor material.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, too, because sometimes I wonder if, as a society, we simplify, you know, oh, the solution here is that we ban books. Right. But what's interesting about that is, I think the bigger discussion here is, how are we educating children? And I know that we blame the schools a lot, but how are we at home educating our children? How are schools working with parents and involving them in the conversation? And how do we know what a full truth is or what a full story is if we're going to eliminate some of the books that can reveal things. I think there's a deeper conversation here. And at the surface, the answer for a lot of people is, well, let's just ban books. I don't know if you agree with that.
Absolutely. I think that what's really at issue here is our lack of ability to empathize and communicate with each other as a society. And I think, you know, your point is well taken that, you know, we blame the educators, we blame the librarians, we label people when really what we need to do is build back up those critical thinking skills and to allow our communities to really, like, you know, create those carve-out exceptions for parents and community members who really feel strongly about certain content, you know, that's inconsistent with religious or other values, right? We can do that. We can build in those exceptions. There's exceptions built in everywhere. But before we get to that point, you know, we do need to have these critical thinking conversations where we can talk to each other about what is truth, you know, what we believe should be included in the curriculum that children are receiving. You know, as educators and librarians, it's our job to give students the tools to critically engage with information presented to them, especially in this era of mal, mis, and disinformation. You know, and we need to teach them the capacity to handle truths that may be uncomfortable and difficult.
It's interesting too, Jordan, as you're saying that, because I was just having this conversation with my husband actually the other day. Whether people like him or you don't, you know, political views, whatever. Tucker Carlson, who people know is the ousted TV journalist and anchor for Fox News, he has been wildly popular on X, formerly known as Twitter, and he recently did a 2-hour sit down interview with Vladimir Putin. Now, there were calls for him to be, you know, sent out of the U.S. and we should shun him and all that. And what was interesting is while I was talking about this with my husband, from a journalistic standpoint, we have completely lost sight of what journalists are supposed to do. What we're supposed to do is go to the source. What we're supposed to do is get every side of the story. And whether you like Tucker Carlson or you don't, that's what the guy did. He went and sat down with Vladimir Putin. And it's not like we're not sitting down with both sides. And again, I do understand, obviously, there's controversy of, do you sit down with people like Alex Jones? Do you sit down with people who are, again, causing mayhem and causing mass destruction? But it's sort of that same concept of, are we then just closing information to the public and allowing people to make their own opinions on things, or allowing people to get the full story if we say, hey, you know what, this is an evil guy, he's doing something awful, we're just not going to talk to them? I think there is a point there where, I don't know if we're in agreement with that, but I think it's become very challenging beyond just banning books in libraries. I think we're too afraid as a society to say, hey, we need to hear from everybody. We need to hear from everybody in every viewpoint and allow people to make their own judgment calls from there. I don't know if you agree.
Oh, absolutely. So one of my favorite quotes comes from Justice Brennan out of there's a case called Texas v. Johnson. And his quote is, if there is a bedrock principle underlying the First Amendment, it is that the government may not prohibit the expression of an idea simply because society finds the idea itself offensive or disagreeable. And I think that goes to what you're saying. You know, right now we are so polarized, right? Mm-hmm. Our political beliefs, our views on sexuality, gender, race, everything, the economy, gas prices, whatever it is, whatever your belief is, you have it and you hold it so dear that simply because we disagree, we believe we shouldn't hear the opposite side or we shouldn't get more information about it. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is where these book bans and these censorship fights, that's where it really stems from. It stems from a lack of empathy and it stems from fear.
Well, here's another question I have for you, Jordan Jefferson, again, associate professor, director of the law library at Quinnipiac University, talking about censorship and book banning. What do you think, though? I understand, like you were saying, there are some exceptions to the rule. But what do you think about changes that we have seen in school, like the fact that we don't do the pledge? maybe that seems like a minor thing, but like I have a 5.5-year-old. When he asked me and my husband earlier this week during President's Day, when we were talking about George Washington and everything, founding father, all of that, he said, how do you and dad know all the words? I was like, we said it in school every single day before the school day started. And he said, well, we don't do it in school. And that is something that was eliminated. Again, I don't know if that was because there was an exception to the rule of, hey, it's under God, or, you know, we're valuing America or whatever you want to call it. But I think that also is a point that needs to be addressed, which is that we are saying, hey, we should allow all sorts of books to be, you know, a value, to be open to the public. If people want it, great. But we're also in the same breath saying, OK, but we're not going to, as a class, honor our country and say the Pledge of Allegiance and teach our children about, you know, our military and honoring America under God because of the religious factor in that.
Well, I think that's a different argument, and I think it sort of conflates two things. There's a First Amendment point there, which is, you know, you cannot be required to say, the government cannot require you to say or do anything that you do not want to say or do. And, you know, the Pledge of Allegiance really only started in schools in like the 1930s or so. So really, it's only become part of our cultural zeitgeist, you know, over the last 100 years. So I do think, you know, there's First Amendment protections for speech in books, and there's First Amendment protections against speech in the pledge.
So you're okay, though, with that being eliminated?
I don't really have an opinion on the Pledge of Allegiance one way or the other. I'm not anti the pledge. I'm not pro the pledge. I'm anti-censorship. Like I said, I don't know that not saying the pledge, they say the pledge in my child's school, and some people say it and some people don't. I think that's the same sort of thing. You read the book or you don't.
Yeah. I like right? that. Like, but I like that option even. I love that
right?
option. Like, I love that your child's school does it, and if kids don't want to do it, they don't have to. I love
right.
that.
Like there should be no requirement.
Mm-hmm.
Right. We're in a country that doesn't force you to love it. It doesn't say that you have to leave if you hate it.
Right.
Right. That's the point of America. That's the best part about America, is that we have that freedom. And so, you know, I believe that the First Amendment gives us that right in both books and in the Pledge of Allegiance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know why others, you know, school districts make different decisions based on the fear of getting sued. That I can't speak to.
Yeah. Well, no, but I appreciate even just getting your professional insight on this, and certainly, you know, you know your stuff on it, and I do appreciate getting that and learning more about this. And certainly we'll see, like, in this, again, this Goshen situation, what happens. But just in general, being able to talk about it more freely, I think, you know, I couldn't agree with you more that we live in a society right now where we would rather kind of push our own ideals. And sometimes mm-hmm. that means, at the surface, eliminating stuff. And I don't really think that's the answer. Yeah. So
yeah.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, I think, you know, when people are afraid of something, or they don't want to discuss something, or they're, you know, they don't understand something, it's easier to just push it aside mm-hmm. rather than have the hard conversation. And so, you know, book banning, I think, is just that in a more tangible form.
Interesting. Well, Jordan Jefferson, this has been wonderful to have you on the show. Thank you so much for sharing your insight, and maybe we'll talk again soon.
Thank you so much, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. Jordan Jefferson, again, Associate Professor and Director of the Law Library at Quinnipiac University here on WICC.
It's time to get out and explore.
Melissa in the Morning brings you science you may not know on Southern Connecticut's news and information leader, WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
I know we're a little early to start marking our calendars, but you might want to keep your eyes to the skies in just a few short weeks, because in early April, the 2024 total solar eclipse will be back in parts of the United States. And of course, there are parts of Connecticut where you might be able to see a little bit of the phenomenon. But our own David Mestre, you think he would just sit back and hang out here in Connecticut? No siree. He is taking a trip with some of the University of Bridgeport students to also conduct a pretty cool project. And it's going to be happening in amidst the eclipse going on. So David is here to talk more about this exciting opportunity. David, welcome back. How are you?
Thank you.
This is so cool. First of all, you're going where? To Texas?
Yeah, so we're going to, a team of us from the University of Bridgeport, we're heading down to a place called Junction, Texas. So we got to fly into San Antonio, and then from San Antonio, we make our way west to a small town called Junction. And right there in Junction is a center from, I guess it's the Texas Tech. And they have this little satellite campus. And so we're just going to pack that satellite campus with bunches of people. The Exploratorium from San Francisco is going to be live casting from there. We've got a couple of university students that are going to be there, too, from other universities. A girls' school from Texas is going to be there, too. And yours truly.
I love that. This is so cool, David. Now tell us a little bit about this launch that you're going to be involved with.
Well, so we're part of what's called Nationwide Eclipse Ballooning Project. And that's a NASA project. And so there are about 53 teams all across the United States, and we're going to be launching these large weather balloons. They're pretty big, probably about the size of twice the size of your living room. So these are fairly large balloons. They have electronic payloads that are attached to them, and they do a bunch of different things. So one of the things they have a camera on board, and we can literally beam down to a receiving dish on the ground that's tracking the balloon. We can actually beam down live imagery of what the camera sees from the balloon's flight, and then send that off to NASA. And NASA will actually broadcast the live video footage to anybody that wants to catch our website. So that's one of the cool things that we'll be doing. In addition to which, it's just a challenging project to coordinate 53 different teams, to time the launches of the balloons, to make sure that the balloons are flying safely. In fact, NASA has a way to cut down any balloon that it feels is kind of straying in a place that it shouldn't be going. And then on top of that, once the balloon is at a certain altitude, we actually have a way to send a command to the payload. It'll open up a little valve, let a little helium out, and actually the balloon will just hover at about 70,000 feet and stay there until we want it to come down. And sometimes it doesn't. We actually did a dress rehearsal back in October.
Right.
And, so we were out there, and our balloon didn't want to come down. So we opened the valve, closed it, opened it up, closed it. Yep. No, we just had to wait until nighttime. When the temperature went down cool enough for the balloon to come down, and it actually landed in somebody's front yard. So that was we had to call the sheriff's office.
It was a whole ordeal.
Yeah.
That's so neat, though.
We could see it. We were tracking it. It was almost like Google Earth. You can actually see our little balloon just kind of.
Wow.
And on Google Earth, you could actually see this guy's backyard, and the only tree in this guy's backyard, that's where the balloon landed. So I can't believe that.
That's really neat. And again, David Mestre is here for Science You May Not Know. We're talking about the eclipse. This is a NASA project.
This is NASA,
So cool.
Yeah, so it's great because it's all funded through NASA agencies. The state of Connecticut actually has this thing called the Connecticut Space Grant. It's a way for NASA to fund NASA projects through the state of Connecticut to affiliate members of the NASA Connecticut Space Grant. So there are a number of universities that are actually part of that consortium. You know, University of Bridgeport, Fairfield University, Yale University, and even Housatonic Community College is part of that consortium too. So they can actually tap those resources and do a bunch of different projects. So one of the things that we did too, tapping those resources, University of Bridgeport and Wesleyan, and I believe University of Hartford, we built a working together. We actually built a robot monkey.
Oh, I saw the robot monkey when I went to the University of Bridgeport. He was really cool.
Yeah, so this is a package. Imagine like an Omaha steak box, which is literally what it was.
Yeah.
We poked a hole into it, made a little window, and inside there was a little monkey. And the monkey's name is Ham, which stands for High Altitude Monkey. it's true. And so what we did was that we actually launched this monkey, and you could remotely control the robot monkey from the ground. And it had a camera, so we got a live footage of the monkey in the capsule. And the monkey was actually dressed in a spacesuit, too.
Yes, he's so cute.
He's an astronaut. He's our astronaut.
Of course.
And it had a window, so you could actually see the monkey. There's the window, and you could see what was happening outside the window. And you know, the balloon goes up, and this package is actually going up to, you know, however altitude that we send it to.
Wow.
And we're actually getting live video footage from Ham capsule, and Ham could talk to us too. So if you asked it certain questions, it could respond, and it could actually ask, you know, you could ask it certain telemetry questions like, how high are you? And it would look at its instrument panel and say, I am at 30,000 feet.
Yeah. That's amazing. That's
so
really incredible.
We invented high-altitude puppetry.
Wow. But it's amazing. And again, these images are going directly back to NASA, right? I mean, they're able to take the footage that you're getting, and that really benefits their, you know, what their missions have.
Yeah. So there's a bunch of different things that the Nationwide Eclipse Ballooning Project is going to do. It's going to teach the next generation of engineers. So this is a really hard project. You know, the electronics, the communications, the telemetry, all of these things are really hard to do. And so this is a real challenge for a lot of engineering students. The video, how do we download that video? How do we send it off onto the internet? How do we, you know, all of that stuff is and then the challenge of actually doing ballooning. That's, oh my gosh. I mean, these, you know, the imagine a giant balloon on top of your head. You've got white gloves because your skin can't touch the latex of the balloon or you'll pop it. And that's going to be, oh my God, that's going to be the logistics of getting tanks of helium out into like some guy's, you know, ranch in the middle of Texas.
Oh my gosh, crazy.
You know, you're just doing all of this stuff just to get to that moment because the eclipse is only going to happen at that time. And you can't miss it. So all of this has to work. All of this has to be organized, the logistics and all of that, so that we can catch this moment of the total solar eclipse
so
that our
cool.
balloon is up at the right altitude to do it.
Now, of course, people like me and my listeners, we will not be down in Junction, Texas, I should say, to do this very amazing opportunity and participate in this project. Here in Connecticut, though, are we able to catch the total eclipse?
So in Connecticut, you won't catch the total solar eclipse. I know, it's a bummer, yeah. However, here's the deal. So even if you are still in the state of Connecticut, it just turns out that the path of the eclipse shadow, you know, the darkest part of the eclipse, what we call the umbra of the eclipse shadow, that's going to be zooming by, okay? So imagine this alignment of Earth, Sun, and Moon. Imagine the Moon casting a shadow on the Earth. And because of the astronomical motions that are just ridiculous, this shadow is moving across the United States at about 1,500 miles an hour. That's how fast this thing is happening. So even us in Junction, we're only going to see totality when the alignment is perfect and the Moon is completely covering the face of the Sun. That's only going to last for probably about maybe like 3 minutes. But what you'll see is what's called a partial eclipse. And so it looks like in Connecticut, anywhere from 90% to almost 94.5% of the face of the sun is going to be eclipsed by the moon.
Wow.
So that's a big chunk. But even though that's a big chunk, like 94, 95% of the moon is covered, 95% of the sun is covered by the moon, eclipsed by the moon,
yeah.
It's still going to be super bright. So you still need to wear
sunglasses.
Solar eclipse glasses.
Right, I remember the glasses. That was so cool
a
few years ago.
Now, if you want to be an eclipse chaser, where you need to be is in New York. Ah, that's where things get interesting.
Oh,
and that's not
too far away. You can make that work.
So,
okay.
That's right. So you can make this work. You should do this, okay? So what you need to do is you need to take a drive out of Connecticut into the eclipse path that is zooming through upstate New York. Okay. So okay. So I'm looking at you. You know, like buffalo and all that kind of stuff. So they're going to see a total solar eclipse.
Cool.
This is what I recommend. So this is like bar none one of the most amazing things that anybody can see the sky do. I mean, you can see shooting stars, you can see the moon, wonderful sunsets. That's all cool. They all pale in comparison to an app.
A total eclipse. Totally.
Yeah,
so
you got to see it, and because if you miss it, the next time any kind of a solar eclipse will be visible here in the United States is going to be 2044.
Oh, geez. Okay. Well, we should definitely not wait another 20 years to do this.
And do not.
New York's not that far away, David.
Yeah, Vermont, New York. So those are all within striking distance of people in Connecticut to be able to do that traveling safely, but do that traveling and get into that eclipse path. And even if you're just, you know, somewhere where you're just under that shadow,
yeah.
I guarantee you, you're gonna get a bug, and that bug is gonna make you want to see more eclipses sometime.
Sounds amazing. David Mestre, I tell you, you always make Science You May Not Know so interesting, and can't wait to get closer and closer to that date, and then when you come back from Texas, hear how everything goes. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Take care.
You too.